We're working it out.
I call this meeting of the House Commerce Committee to order. We do have a quorum present. May I have a motion to approve the minutes for April 3rd, 2024, members? Representative Cleavorn moves approval of the minutes for April 3rd, 2024. Members, any discussion to that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes for April 3rd, 2024 are approved. Our first bill on the agenda today is House File 4461. I will move House File 4461 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. And I will also move the A2 author's amendment. Rep. Hollins, would you give us a little bit of background?
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. Thank you, Committee. Yes, I asked for a couple of seconds to just explain what the amendment does, because it does change the bill pretty significantly. So it does three important things. The first one is it addresses the amount that we are asking for, the fee for licensing. And this is an amount that was told to us by the Department of Commerce. They provided that amount and said this is how much the licensing and reapplication for licensing needs to be. Secondly, it strikes the word purchasing from any part of the bill so that this bill really applies to just the selling of scrap copper. And then third, it strikes the line electrical on line 3.13 to say that people who perform electrical and contract work pursuant to section 326B are deemed to hold a license for the purpose of this bill. And it also states that a person who is who has a section 608 technician certification is also deemed to hold a license to sell scrap metal.
All right. Members, any discussion to the A2 author's amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The motion prevails and the A2 amendment is adopted. Representative Hollins, to your bill as amended.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members. I'm here today to shed light on a pressing issue affecting many of our cities and towns across Minnesota, copper wire theft. While it may seem like a distant concern to some, its impacts reverberate throughout all of our communities, from local businesses shrouded in darkness to telecommunication disruptions to parks that are sitting useless because they are perpetually unlit. In the city of St. Paul, there are over 2,000 streetlights that are out due to copper wire theft, and the city is continually paying to have those lights rewired. Last I heard, we've spent just over $1.2 million simply repairing gutted lampposts. We had an incident happen in my district where a gentleman was hit and killed by a car, he and his dog, on Christmas Eve. And it was at least in part due to the fact that the lights were pitch black, that the street was completely dark. And that was the moment when I realized that this is really more than just a mere inconvenience or a disruption in our infrastructure, but really it's a public safety issue at the most fundamental level. So since January, I've been partnering with the City of St. Paul to work on a legislative solution to this crisis, one that we believe will curb the selling of illegally obtained copper without overburdening the scrap metal industry. This bill would create a licensing structure for selling scrap copper, requiring individuals who want to sell scrap copper to obtain an annual license from the Department of Commerce. The license would be reviewed by the Department of Commerce. And as mentioned before, licensed electricians, elevator operators and inspectors, plumbers, water conditioning, people who work in water conditioning, construction contractors, residential trades, high pressure piping, and boiler inspectors would not be impacted by this new rule. The current language, as amended, is supported by the IBEW, the Minnesota Electrical Association, Minnesota Chiefs of Police, Xcel Energy, Lumen, also known as CenturyLink, Business Review Council of St. Paul, the League of Minnesota Cities, Metro Cities, and the Metro Park Agencies. But I want to note that this crisis extends beyond St. Paul and Minneapolis, and that's why we need to take a statewide solution. To that end, you'll find a packet in, or you'll find a letter in your packet that with support from 38 mayors from across Minnesota, and these are mayors from urban and rural cities, small and large cities. I'm really looking forward to the conversation that we're going to have today, and I'd like to turn it over to my testifiers.
As you can see, we have a full room today and a full agenda, so I just wanted to note for everyone that all the testifiers have been asked to keep their testimony to 2 minutes, and we will be timing. So first, we have on the list Melvin Carter, Mayor of St. Paul, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you so much for having us here. My name is Melvin Carter, and I serve as the mayor of the city of St. Paul, one of the communities that have been hardest hit by rampant copper wire theft. This proposed legislation gets to the root cause of this statewide problem for us by requiring a license to sell copper scrap wire, effectively disincentivizing potential thieves from targeting our city infrastructure in the first place. To be quite clear, people steal the wire because they can sell stolen wire, and if we eliminate or make it significantly harder to sell stolen wire, then we'll eliminate the incentive to steal it in the first place. Over the past couple of years, we've seen a real troubling surge in copper wire theft because the seemingly small monetary gain from stolen copper wire is obviously desirable to some folks, but for the $50 that you can get for the copper scrap copper out of a light post, it comes at about up to $2,000 cost to our community per incident. It goes beyond, as the representative said, it goes beyond inconvenience to communities. It leaves our communities in the dark and compromises the safety of our residents. Taxpayer dollars meant to fund essential city services have been diverted to address the unmitigated theft. As Representative Holland said, last year alone, we allocated over $1.2 million to repair and replace streetlights and traffic signals that were damaged by copper theft. This rate of theft is very high, and in some instances, we've seen copper stolen right out of the lights we've replaced literally the following day. With no sign of slowing, copper wire theft has forced us to add $500,000 to our budget this year because it's so, the impacts are so enormous on us. As Representative Holland said, we had a tragic incident that occurred on Christmas Eve of this year as Steve Wirtz and his dog were hit by a car, fatally struck by a vehicle on a street that had been impacted by wire theft and where the lights had been out. Despite recent safety upgrades at that intersection, which included a concrete median, a dedicated crosswalk, and other things, those overhead streetlights weren't working. But this isn't just about for us responding to emergencies. Our focus on public safety obviously can't just be responding to emergencies after they happen. It's got to be identifying the cycles that cause emergencies to occur and reoccur in our communities, and that's why this focus is important for us. This isn't just a St. Paul issue. It's not just a metropolitan issue. This is a statewide issue, as noted by the sign-on letter that you have in your packets from 38 different mayors across our state. Obviously, that includes me. That includes the city of Minneapolis. That includes cities as far away as Virginia on the Iron Range and communities as small as Jim Lake with a population of 339. This is a statewide problem that demands a statewide solution. As I said, in St. Paul, we've spent over $1 million in the last year. That's St. Paul alone as one of those 38 communities. The policy that we have presented in front of you comes with a fiscal note of somewhere in the neighborhood of $50,000 a year, so a significant savings to taxpayers across our state if we can get this work right. We've seen the success of state policies in curbing other forms of theft, including catalytic converter theft, through registration and accountability. Representative Holland's bill provides the direction needed to combat copper wire theft as well. By revising current state statute to require a license to sell scrap copper wire and all sales to be tracked, we can ensure accountability and legitimacy. I'm grateful for the leadership of Representative Holland and Senator Pappas for bringing forward this legislation that offers a meaningful and much needed solution. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Our next testifier is Kurt Hallstrom. Deputy Chief Hallstrom, if you want to come forward and state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
I'm Curtis Hallstrom. I'm Deputy Chief of Operations for the City of St. Paul. Thank you for the opportunity to speak in front of you all today. The mayor put it very, very well. There's not really much that I can add other than this piece of copper that is here today. When it's in the ground in the City of St. Paul, it looks like this. And it's actually marked with the City of St. Paul. So in an effort to take away the market for this piece of wire and requiring that licensure requirement for the person that steals this and turns it into this, there's no way we can trace this back to the location that it was located, thus being able to utilize the current laws and bills that are we're able to operate with. So and it's beyond this wire. You'll see that the bill covers all copper, We're seeing increasing numbers of air conditioning units that are stripped of their copper. I'm sure if you have a home or an apartment, the air conditioner unit that sits outside your house, think about it come June when you go out there to turn on your central air, and there's no cold air. It's just blowing warm, steamy air on you because all of the copper in your air conditioning unit has been stolen and stripped out and recycled. And, you know, it's in a completely different format than it was when it was in your unit. So there's no way for us to be able to go back and trace that to where it came from. This will allow us to track who's selling large quantities of copper, and if they don't have a legitimate license to have that copper wire, then we would pay more attention to them as law enforcement agencies. So appreciate your time today. Thank you for your support.
Thank you. Next, we have Dan Nizjolek. Come forward, state your name for the record. Welcome to the committee.
Dan Nizjolek, Deputy Director, Department of Safety Inspections, City of St. Paul. Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for your consideration today. What's before you, as the mayor has articulated, is a serious issue for the City of St. Paul. What's before you is amendment to statute identifying an issue that we have with current statute. Currently, metal scrap dealers have a lot of requirements of data that need to record for each transaction. They need a photo ID of the person. They need to document, describe, and weigh the metal they're receiving. They have to document the vehicle, license plate number, and a variety of other things currently when they are purchasing metal. One of the challenges, of course, is they don't know for sure who they're getting the metal from. So the solution that we're looking at, which is once again adding a tool to our toolbox, which like anything else, having a comprehensive solution, is if you want to sell copper, you need to get a license. As the Department of Safety and Inspection, City of St. Paul, we manage the business licensing unit of our city. We find licensing as a very strong proactive, but also compliance too. Proactive, we get to know who is requesting a license to make sure that they are the right people for a license. Compliance-wise, if somebody is acting in a way they shouldn't have a license, we're able to take away. So what is before you is an amendment to require that anybody selling copper in the state of Minnesota would be required to have a license. Fairly simple solution, but should have some really good outcomes. And we're excited about the opportunity for that to happen as we work with our metal scrap dealers. It should make their jobs easier by the fact that they are now dealing with somebody who's licensed. In addition, whenever they take in stolen copper, and as the police department would confiscate that, that would impact their bottom line. So I see it as a win-win as we move forward licensing. We're selling, we'll make a better solution, hopefully deal with the significant community issues that we're seeing in the city of St. Paul. Thank you for your consideration today.
Thank you. Next, we have Brian Dodds. Deputy Director Dodds, come forward, state your name for the record. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. I'm Brian Dodds, Deputy Director and City Engineer for Minneapolis Public Works, and I'm here to support House File 4461 as amended. Last year, 9.5 miles of copper was stolen in Minneapolis. 7 miles of that was on city streets, and 2.5 miles of that was on Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board trails. That's about the distance to drive from Minneapolis City Hall to this building. This has caused great impacts to the quality of life and livability for those that live, work, and play in Minneapolis. Part of what makes Minneapolis such a special place is the lakes and parkways, and unfortunately, these are some of the areas that have been hardest hit by wire theft. Between our streets and trails, we estimate that over $450,000 it will cost to repair the damages to date. On the street system alone, there are about 50,000 streetlights in the city of Minneapolis, half of which are powered overhead and the other half are powered underground, and that's about 400 miles of copper that's in the ground in these type of situations that could be targeted next. Replacing the stolen wire takes our crews off their regularly scheduled construction and maintenance work and puts us behind in other commitments we have made to our residents. In addition to the direct financial costs, these acts of thievery harm the morale of our residents and our electricians doing the work. Often we would finish repair only to have the same stretch of wire stolen again within another few days. One example, our crews worked 3 weeks to replace 2 miles of wire, only to have that wire stolen again in less than a week. Very frustrating. Crews are dejected, and residents were frustrated by, again, losing the lighting in their neighborhood. We've attempted to harden our pole bases, but the thieves used hammers, crowbars, grinders, other tools to break them open. and get access to the wire. In the last few months, we've done a pilot test of using aluminum wire in our street lighting system as a replacement for the copper, as aluminum salvage value is about a quarter of that of copper. And we've labeled those light poles to tell the thieves it is not worth their time to steal this wire. We see this as a less than ideal option, as we have concerns over the long-term durability of the aluminum wire in our environment. But we prefer to use copper wire, which, if undisturbed, will serve for decades into the future. And it's not just steel or street lighting wire for copper. It's also, in the last 2 years, Minneapolis and St. Paul have jointly rolled out an electric vehicle share program, and with about 70 curbside charging stations across the two cities. And Minneapolis alone has had 80 of those power cords, those cables that charge from those stations, cut off and stolen. And so that's an impact of about $80,000 in repairs of that system.
And if you could conclude your testimony, that'd be helpful.
I will do that. So we need to take away the incentives of the thieves that have done this brazen activity. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you. And last, we have Jeremy Estenson. Mr. Estenson, if you can come forward, state your name for the record, and welcome back to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members, Jeremy Estenson with the TAF Law Firm. I represent ISRI, the Institute of Scrap Recycling Industries. And first off, let me say we appreciate the deference the author and the advocates have taken in trying to carve out the scrap recycling industry from any additional burdens. You heard Mr. Nizialek, I hope I pronounced that correctly, mention some of the things that we already do. And that came out of the last time the legislature talked about copper. And that was after the foreclosure crisis. Mm-hmm. But copper was being torn out of the walls of foreclosed on buildings. There was a very real problem. And industry got together with law enforcement and prosecutors and came up with a whole series of new tools to help those folks solve crimes. And we hope to deter crimes. I'm not necessarily here to oppose the bill. I want to talk about a couple aspects of the bill and then perhaps provide a suggestion, a third way that might actually work better. And I also want to say we share your desire to curb theft, promote safety, and all those sorts of things. And selfishly, we want to recycle the stuff. And for the reasons Mr. Nizialek mentioned, a lot of scrap material that's stolen doesn't end up in Minnesota because if I drive in with a load of stolen stuff, my driver's license is captured on camera, my face, I sign a bunch of paperwork, so on and so forth. And while criminals are not maybe always the smartest among us, they're not that dumb. However, the chief problem with this bill is that most criminals don't, they're not famous for having their paperwork in order. They don't always stop down to the DMV and get a license before they steal copper. And so the impact of this bill is to be that any of us who might want to recycle some copper would be forced to get a license. And at $250, we think the impact, human nature impact, is that Representative Cagle, we all know, is a DIYer, an altruistic DIYer. She probably will bring her copper into the scrapyard, even if it means not getting as much as the $250 would cost her. I can speak for myself and say, I might just throw it in the garbage if my options are spend $250 or recycle. And I understand that the option to recycle still exists. We have some suggestions. Maybe we do away with the fee. Perhaps there could be a de minimis amount of copper that folks could bring in should we choose to advance with the bill. Also, we're unsure why this is in front or is under the jurisdiction of Commerce instead of DPS. But again, this has moved kind of quickly. We'll get that sorted out with the authors and the advocates.
And Mr. Estenson, you're about 2.5 minutes. If you could wrap things up, that'd be helpful.
Yes, sir. The third way. There are states right now using an FBI-based database, a real-time communication system, that enables law enforcement to communicate directly with scrapyards. So if Representative Schultz's air conditioning unit was stolen, law enforcement would put it into the system within a radius chosen by law enforcement. All scrapyards in states like Colorado are forced to receive those alerts and be on the lookout. It does much more than that. But what that would do is force real-time communication like we used to have, archaically, in an ad hoc coffee group prior to COVID. And for reasons I don't understand, that group between industry folks and law enforcement has disappeared. We'd like to put that back. Mr. Chair, thank you for your consideration, members.
Thank you. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify as to this bill? Seeing none, we'll move on to member discussion and questions. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hollins on this bill. Following that, this is kind of in follow-up to last year's bill as it relates to recycling and that one having to do with catalytic converters. Number one, I'll just mention for the record that this has been something representing a rural community that we've certainly been dealing with for a long time, too. By way of background, the neighboring house to where I grew up, while it was abandoned, had its copper stripped from it. Secondarily, in the last week in central Minnesota, $10,000 worth of copper was stolen from an irrigation pivot on an area farm outside of Royalton. But I say that also knowing that these things and theft is a crime. And we have a bill before us here that could continue to hamper small businesses and individuals who do good work in recycling. And so my question for you, Representative Hollins, is are you committed to finding a solution before the end of the legislative session and this bill moves forward that can bring more humility for small business owners?
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. Thank you, Representative Schultz. I am definitely committed to trying my best. I can't promise anything, obviously, but it's certainly been my intention to not hamper businesses, which is why we took out the buying component from the bill. That was after meeting with scrap metal dealers and hearing their concerns about this. And I think that we know that this is not quite like catalytic converters because there's not a serial number on there. There's not a way to trace it. As we showed you, they can just strip the information off of it and have blank wires. But I am committed to working with the stakeholders that are going to be impacted by it and trying to find a workable solution.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I just on this topic, I've heard concerns from small business owners in my own community. Legal businesses operating and doing good work, right? This is recycling work in our communities, and frankly, a lot of concerns shared about the bill passed last year. But I just wanted to see, could we get a little bit more time, Mr. Chair, and just ask an additional question about what another solution could be from Mr. Estenson, who testified?
Do you have so Mr. Estenson testified as to what his proposed solution is. Do you have a question about what he proposed, or what are you wanting to know from Mr.
Estenson?
Mr. Estenson, you want to come down?
Yeah, at the very end of his testimony, Mr. Chair, he was making more reference to a particular solution that we're no longer doing, and I just wanted to get a little bit more definition on that.
Mr. Estenson, if you could just speak a little briefly about why we're no longer doing or what we're no longer doing.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schultz, thank you. What used to take place is a bit of an ad hoc group. Law enforcement and scrap entities got together and talked about what was going on. One of the challenges that are persistent as different commodities get stolen when market rates bear it out. It was catalytic converters. It's been copper before. It might be aluminum in the future. Now the car manufacturers are using more of it. They discussed what was going on, discussed names, talked about, what in an informal way. What Colorado and a variety of states are doing are using a database tool that protects everybody's information, protects proprietary information from industry, protects sensitive law enforcement information, but it allows the two to communicate. For instance, those sprinkler heads you mentioned, they don't show up at a scrapyard looking like a sprinkler head. Mm-hmm. And in fact, when they get there, they won't be called sprinkler heads. They'll be called copper number two or whatever. Well, that doesn't mean anything to law enforcement, just like sprinkler head doesn't mean anything to the scrap industry. This tool has been used successfully. And Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to pass out some news articles with some success stories.
You're welcome to email them to the committee administrator, who can email them to members of the committee.
Thank you.
One last follow-up, Representative Schultz.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I actually had one additional question for the author of the bill, and that is, based upon the amendment, it looks like it's a $250 fee for licensing. Is that something that is an annual cost, or is that something that is a one-time cost to become licensed in Minnesota?
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Schultz. It is an annual cost. And I do recognize that is a high annual cost. It was not something that the city or I wanted, but the Department of Commerce said that was what it would cost for them to do the licensing procedure.
Representative Dodson.
Thank you, Chair. Representative, I've got a question for the representative here. question I have, number one, is I think we can all admit that there's a challenge that we're facing by these testifiers, these cities showing that they've had challenges. But the question I would have is, what is the penalty right now if someone is caught stealing city property?
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. I believe, and I was going to say I can rely on my experts, but I believe it depends on the amount. It's just like any theft, right? I mean, you know.
Looks like Deputy Chief Hallstrom's coming down. Deputy Chief, if you want to answer Representative Donsith's question.
Yeah. So we have, there's theft and burglary tools and possession of stolen property charges that are currently on the books, and we have been successful in getting some burglary charges. The problem with the laws as they sit is, as it was just pointed out, that once the copper is removed from the location in which it was stolen, it's almost impossible for us to be able to put it back there. So the current laws don't necessarily allow us to follow that traditional possession of stolen property as we would with a car or a catalytic converter, as it was passed a session or two ago, where it has to be marked. We can trace that catalytic converter all the way back to the vehicle in which it was removed. Once the copper sheathing has been removed, it's nearly impossible for law enforcement to say where that copper came from.
That's the first thing. One more follow-up question on that would be, how many have you seen prosecuted for stealing copper wire in the city of Minneapolis, St. Paul? Because I'm assuming it's not an easy process. It might take a little bit of time to extract the wires out, so some of them probably did get caught.
Deputy Chief?
I'm sorry.
It's okay. Go ahead.
It takes very little time to remove the wire from the ground. The city is currently prosecuting, or with the county, about 30 cases in the city of St. Paul.
Deputy Chief, I assume that if you catch them in the act, you can also charge damage to property. You mentioned theft and receiving and burg tools, but
we certainly can. And again, I'm not an attorney, but the laws in this particular case haven't really caught up and kept up with the damage that's being caused. So criminal damage to property is based upon value of damage that's caused, and it's actually the effort to go put the wire back in the ground and the other accessories that go along with the value of where they're coming up with $2,000 per string to replace. So the laws, though they seem straightforward, they're complex in what can be charged and what we're successful in getting charges on. So the possession of burglary tools is the highest level of crime that we currently have that we can use as a tool to combat this issue.
Do you have one more follow-up, Representative Johnson?
Follow-up question. What would that consequence look like? What is the penalty for possession of burglary tools if they have them?
It's a lower level felony charge.
Very good. Thank you.
All right. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hollins. Just a quick question. In the amendment, you on line 3.31, you changed that to just chapter 326B, which seems to offer actually a lot more protection for folks who just should be automatically included. And I quickly skimmed it, but I'm just wondering if you can just tell us, does that include all like building contractors, the trades, all of those folks, building trades?
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. Thank you, Representative New Brindley. That's correct. Construction contractors, residential trades, and then folks who work with boilers, high pressure piping, elevators, plumbing, et cetera. I think the longer we had more conversations with more stakeholders, we recognized that there were more people who had legitimate reasons to have copper with them.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hollins. I appreciate that. The only other comment I would make, you know, I mean, that is obvious to me, and I appreciate that change. You know, Mr. Esteson mentioned a group, you know, it's true that we don't want to discourage folks like a DIYer who may, on very rare occasion, have reason to do this, and we don't want to discourage that from happening. So we may want to include, I like the idea of just a de minimis amount that wouldn't require a license. It seems like there's some logic to that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hollins, Representative New Brindley got at, I guess, one of my questions to you. Obviously, this is a bigger part of a broader crime problem, and ideally we would focus the burden less on people who are trying to do the right thing and more on people who are trying to break the law. I did have a couple of questions about the suspension or revocation provisions on like starting line 4.15. 4.17 says if the applicant engages in fraudulent activity that violates state or federal law. I was wondering what the bill is trying to get at with that. What can you give an example of what fraudulent activity would be that would allow for suspension or revocation or probation of a license?
Representative Hollins.
Thank you. See, now you're getting into the part that I don't have as much say in. But I believe, thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative. I believe the idea is that if you are purchasing illegally obtained copper, then you can have your license to be a scrap metal dealer revoked or suspended. And that's based on the Department of Commerce looking into that.
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hollins. And I was curious about the next revocation provision as well, and maybe the answer is the same. I was wondering what consumer complaints would be in this context to protect the safety and interest of consumers. That makes sense in some other contexts. I was kind of curious as to what would, in the context of selling copper, and maybe this is just taking language from another place, but I was curious if there's something that's getting at that I'm not really understanding.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. Thank you, Representative Niska. I think that this is just, we're trying to cover all the ways that you might hear about or look, that the department might learn about there being bad behavior in scrap metal dealerships. So certainly if they are tracking a particular seller or tracking somebody who they know to have been engaged in illegal activity, that's something that they could flag and then investigate with that particular scrap metal purchaser. But then also if they're hearing consistent complaints, maybe from somebody who legitimately, maybe one of those contractors that legitimately has copper piping, and they're finding that, you know, they see that there's a bunch of wire coming in that doesn't look legitimate, that that's something that could instigate an investigation by the Department of Commerce as well.
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hollins, I appreciate that. I think maybe the language could be a little tweaked a little bit to more focus it on the concerns that we have here. But I appreciate what you're getting at. So thank you.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if Deputy Chief Hallstrom could come back, we're giving you your exercise today, sir.
I don't think I've ever had to make a mayor get up and sit down this many times.
First off, Deputy Chief, let me thank you and the members of your department for keeping the peace in St. Paul and keeping us safe as residents and guests in the legislature in our capital city. It does mean a lot to us. My question to you is the same kind of question that I asked last year when we were talking about catalytic converters. I really have a problem where Minnesota does something independent in the way of laws on this, when we have North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, and Wisconsin, our immediate neighbors, which Representative Hollins pointed out, she is a member who did not grow up with a border state because she grew up in Hawaii on this. But I'm not an expert on crime, for the record, either investigating or committing for that matter. But my point is, we know that when this stuff is stolen, it's not always going to stay in the area because it can be traced. So it gets fenced out into other areas. And my concern is, what happens if this goes to Marshall or from St. Paul to Hudson and over to Superior and stuff through the state of Minnesota? How do we know how much of that's happening right now? And how will we know, or does this bill help you as law enforcement to be able to keep better track of those kinds of things or identify that as that's getting into to networks and being fenced out or moved quickly through the state into an area that doesn't have this type of detection system?
The record will reflect that Representative Driscoll is not an expert criminal, Deputy Chief.
Are you sure?
Thank you. Valid question, and I would also point that, The catalytic converter bill, that was relatively new legislation for the state of Minnesota and probably for the country. We have seen a significant drop in catalytic converter thefts in the city of St. Paul. We were over 3,500 a year for the last 3 or 4 years up until the passage of that legislation, and we're under 500 for the year 2023 in St. Paul. Will there be some cross-state trafficking of stolen metals and other items? Yes, probably. That brings in the feds, which is a completely different investigation. We're also, looking at the people that we are finding that are out stealing copper wire. They're not linked to organized crime. They may not even have a vehicle that would get them over to Hudson. So we know that the copper wire is going somewhere, and the copper items that are being stolen from air conditioning units and other things, they're going somewhere. And the idea is that we would interrupt that easy sale of the various scrap yards that are throughout the state, and certainly not putting fault on them unless it's clearly identifiable as being stolen. We're not anti scrap or recycling. We are just stop stealing our wire in the city of St. Paul.
Representative Driscoll.
For the record, I'm not a petty criminal either for that, Mr. Chair, just for the record. And I appreciate that. I recognize you've got a problem. As a matter of fact, I've spoken with many businesses that have been affected by this and communities, so I'm not making light of it at all. I just want to make sure that the law that we're putting into place actually has the intended outcome that we want, and that the criminals don't get smarter and moving this stuff through. If you don't have a vehicle, you may have someone who comes to meet you. These are oftentimes rings that are bigger than what we think they are, and you know that more firsthand, and so does our chair as a prosecutor know that these rings are bigger than they may appear in the rearview mirror. So thank you for your time.
Closing comments, Representative Hollins.
Thank you so much for the robust discussion. I truly appreciate it. I am committed to continuing to meet with stakeholders and tighten the bill up as needed. Thank you, committee. I'd appreciate your support.
Representative Katiza Batum renews her motion that House File 4461, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay.
Nay.
The motion prevails, and House File 4461 is recommended to be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Thank you very much. And what will be a recurring theme today is if you are leaving after a bill, that's wonderful. Just try and keep it a little quiet so we can keep working on the bills we have before us. So the next bill on the agenda today is House File 3896 from Representative Brand. Welcome back to the committee. I will move House File 3896 be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Brand, to your bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. The last time that Minnesota Statute 215.0255 modified the insurance requirements was in 2010. In 14 years, the cost of medical care has gone up. Wages would have also gone up in that time, and also funeral expenses have gone up in that time, too. I agree that this is the time to revisit the insurance coverage for third-party companies that pick up and drop off our train workers to train yards. They're the ones that pick them up and drive them on the two-lane roads all across the state and through rush hour traffic in the metro for their jobs. Uninsured motorist coverage, referred to as UM, is a type of car insurance that pays for medical expenses. It also covers passengers who are injured in an accident caused by a driver who does not have liability car insurance, a hit-and-run driver, and a driver whose insurance company denies coverage or goes out of business. Uninsured motorists cover many things, include medical bills, lost wages, if you can't work because of the car accident, pain and suffering, compensation, and those are individual in terms of what a judge decides those to be, and also funeral expenses. According to Forbes, an estimated 9.9% of motorists in Minnesota, just roughly about 1 in 10, happen to be not insured in the state of Minnesota. I'd like to turn it over to Nick Kadich to help convey why he and the workers that he represents thinks the coverage limits are too low.
Mr. Kadich, if you come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you. My name is Nick Kadich, and I am the Minnesota Legislative Director for Smart Transportation Division, a labor union representing conductors, engineers, and yardmasters. So the insurance language in House File 3896 is pretty straightforward. The $1 million uninsured underinsured coverage amount listed in the current statute is no longer sufficient to cover the situation that's been created by the railroads. Railroad train crews spend a lot of time in deadhead transportation, more than most people outside the industry realize. This usually involves a subcontracted crew hauling company, as the railroads have moved away from employing their own staff and vehicles to transport train crews over roadways. So the real world scenario is this. A crew van with a contract driver transporting three railroad employees is hit head on by a drunk driver. With four people experiencing life or career-ending injuries, how fast will $5 million in liability insurance go in this instance? The drunk driver had the state minimum insurance, which wasn't enough to cover a surgery for even one of the occupants. Now, what if multiple vehicles were involved? So under federal law, railroad workers are not eligible for workers' compensation. They are instead part of the Federal Employers Liability Act, which is a fault-based system where the employer must be proven negligent for the employee to be covered. By using a subcontractor, railroads have attempted to remove themselves from this equation, but the workers still need to be covered, which is where this insurance comes in. When the railroad or its contractors are not at fault, the workers must still be covered. So attaining this coverage is not difficult or complicated for an existing motor carrier in Minnesota. This company would already have in place a liability policy under statute and would simply be adding an excess liability policy to it. So these policies, or umbrellas as they're commonly known, are kind of a regular occurrence in our state and probably around this room. We've got umbrella policies protecting ourselves. So the uninsured, underinsured insurance increase is necessary to cover railroad workers in this gap created by outsourcing liability to subcontractors. And I urge you to support the bill, and thank you, and I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you. Next, we have Amber Backus. Ms. Backus, if you want to come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony. And after Ms. Backus, we'll have Aaron Cocking.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Amber Backus with United Strategies here on behalf of the Minnesota Regional Railroads Association. Reliable and safe crew transportation service is critical to keeping railroads running. Under the Federal Hours of Service Law, train crews are permitted to work a limited number of hours per day, so it's critical that the railroad be able to furnish fresh, rested train crews to replace crews whose hours of service time is destined to expire. Many association members, both the national railroads and small Minnesota-based ones, use van services to transport crews to and from their job locations. And a letter from one of the impacted companies is in your packet. The bill before you will make it difficult and expensive for these van services to find coverage. We're not aware of any policies in the marketplace that write $5 million in uninsured, underinsured policies. And I'd like to say that's completely different than the umbrella policies that Mr. Kadish was referring to. But in fact, the standard policy for uninsured, underinsured is $50,000 for more than one person. And the existing crew van law already requires $1 million in coverage for this category, 20 times more than for any other passenger policies. Meanwhile, federal and state laws require for hire carriers of 15 passengers or less to provide $1.5 million in total financial responsibility. The existing crew van law requires $6 million. And this bill increases that number to $10 million, well exceeding the rate of inflation since the law's enactment in 2010. I don't understand the public policy rationale behind mandating this extra insurance coverage for passengers based on their profession, especially since unionized railroad employees have access to numerous other insurance benefits the average Minnesotan does not. This includes the Federal Employers Liability Act claims, which aren't capped, off-track vehicle benefits negotiated in the contracts that provide up to $300,000 in coverage if injuries were sustained in a crew van, generous health insurance through the National Collective Bargaining Agreement, and lastly, United States Railroad Retirement Board benefits, which provide benefits for up to 90 days following an accident. Furthermore, all of these sources of funds would need to be exhausted before uninsured, underinsured insurance comes into play, making the need for a $5 million policy more unreasonable. We agree with the proponents that they should have safe, reliable, and appropriate transportation, but the costs associated with the mandated coverage in House File 3896 have the potential to take carriers out of the marketplace and limit access to available van services. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. And next we have Aaron Cocking. Mr. Cocking, if you'd want to come forward, welcome back to the committee.
Chair Stevenson, members of the committee, for the record, Aaron Cocking, President and CEO of the Insurance Federation of Minnesota. There are two things I think this committee needs to consider before approving Section 1 of this bill. First, let's remember that minimum limits are intended to be just that, minimums. Companies and individuals need to decide for themselves what their risk exposure is and decide from that risk perspective how much insurance they need to purchase. Mandatory UIM limits in Minnesota for personal auto are $25.50. The risk of being struck by an uninsured or underinsured motorist is the same whether you're an individual or part of a commercial unit, such as a railroad van. The change is 200 times greater than that. Why? Secondly, as Ms. Backus referenced, the availability of $5 million minimum limits is going to be incredibly difficult to find, and if they're able to find this coverage at all, it's going to be incredibly expensive. Doing a quick search of the Department of Commerce SURF filing system, we didn't find any filing approvals for 5 million UI-UIM limits. And part of the reason includes the lack of available data for insurers to base their loss projections on. The Insurance Service Office provides estimates of claims costs and loss adjustment expenses for several insurance companies. In a late 2023 filing with the Minnesota Department of Commerce, ISO indicated that the expected increase in claims and claims adjustment costs are 7% and 14% when policy limits are increased from $1 million to $2 million for uninsured and underinsured motorist portions of the commercial auto insurance, and that's respectively. Assuming that these increases, these costs only increase by the same percentage when limits are changed from $2 million to $5 million, which may be an understatement, the resulting expected cost increase would be approximately 14% and 44% each for uninsured and underinsured motorist coverage, respectively. I know it's a lot of math, but I think it's important to understand the impact of that the change is going to make. As these costs also do not consider other insurance company expenses beyond claims and related claims adjustment expenses, the estimated cost impact may be more than 15% and 45% for each of those uninsured, underinsured motorist costs, respectively. Now, as you all know, I've been in front of this committee numerous times. We want to make sure that whatever insurance bills are passed are workable in the marketplace, and that's why I came to testify today. Mr. Chair, I'm happy to try to answer any questions the committee may have on this.
Are there any members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we'll move to member discussion and questions. Discussion to the bill. I'm sorry, we have an amendment. My apologies. Representative O'Driscoll, it is your amendment. So would you like to move the A2?
Before we move the A2, I'd just like to maybe have a discussion.
Sure.
Because I may withdraw the A2 amendment. And I just want to underscore what Mr. Cocking said. And when we talk about policy forms, the Department of Commerce approves those. And what goes into that is, does the insurance company have the wherewithal, the reserves to be able to make these kinds of payments should things happen? And that's why you can't go to your insurance company as a private, in the private lines or in the individual market and get sky's the limit kind of coverage, because the department says, here's where it's feasible for these companies. I was wondering if there's someone from the department today who would come down and maybe answer a few questions that I have about the policies and what might be available in the state of Minnesota.
I'm looking to see if Mr. Well, we do have someone from the department coming down. Representative Driscoll, if you want to ask your question.
Thank you. Maybe she can just identify herself so we know who we're visiting with.
Can you say your name for the record?
Mr. Chair, members, I am Jacqueline Olson. I'm the Assistant Commissioner of Enforcement at the Department of Commerce.
Very good. Thank you. And my question, you heard my question. I'm happy to repeat it again. So your department is responsible and charged with approving policy forms and limits for various coverage. And we don't usually approve the sky is the limit kind of coverage, or we limit that coverage because of the likelihood of incidents or the occurrences, as well as the reserves that are required by companies to carry that to meet those kinds of things. Does the state currently have any policy forms that would be available if this law were put into effect tomorrow or May 1st that carriers could purchase in the state of Minnesota?
Assistant Commissioner Olson. Go ahead.
Representative O'Driscoll, I'm happy to take that question back to our insurance division. That's not my division, so I can't speak to that on their behalf, but I'm happy to take that question back to them and get back to you with an answer for that.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you. Unfortunately, this bill is being laid over, because that is an extremely important consideration. Because if you can't buy it through approved policies in the state of Minnesota, you're forced into the surplus lines market, and it's going to be just chaotic to try to find coverage, and it's going to be very expensive, and that could weigh in on the business decision about what to do as a carrier or as a provider in the state of Minnesota. So I'm hoping that we can get resolution to that and find the right number. And if that right number is the 5 million that you are able to provide policy and form review to make sure that that's available in the state of Minnesota, because I really don't want to have us not have coverage available for something we're mandating here in the state of Minnesota, or force it to go to the surplus lines market. So, Mr. Chair, the reason for the amendment was to basically bring the 5 million down to a million. I think I've made my point, so I'm going to withdraw the amendment at this time.
Representative Driscoll withdraws the A2 amendment. Any further discussion to the bill? Closing comments, Representative Brand.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to hear this. This is also included in another bill, House File 3499. There still is a lot of time left between now and the end of the session for this to be discussed amongst all the parties, and so I look forward to continuing that conversation. And if enacted, this would actually take place August 1st, and so there would be some time. The last thing I would say about this is, though, there probably isn't a lot of options. I wouldn't say that everybody carries this insurance. I would say that every state in the union has a different state minimum, and somehow the insurance companies have found a way to match what the state minimums are. And so as the body that actually creates the laws that other folks follow, I would imagine that at some point they would also follow with an updated amount. Keep in mind, this is 2010 when the last time the legislation passed. And doing some research, I found that there was somewhat of a disagreement about what that number should have been back in 2010 as well. So I will continue to keep that conversation going, and I look forward to passing this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Brandon. With that, the bill is laid over. The next bill on our agenda today is House File 4206 from Representative Hansen. We're having an informational hearing on House File 4206. We won't be taking official action today, so when Representative Hansen, when you are situated, you may describe your bill.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Committee, for today's informational hearing on House File 4206. As elected officials representing our communities, we have all heard about the rising costs of health care and the burdens that that puts on the people that we are here to represent. One of the many reasons for the rising costs of health care and decreased quality of care is the influx of private equity companies and real estate investment trusts who are disrupting the fragile cost of care model in our health care system today, solely for the purposes of putting profits over patients. This bill seeks to implement a moratorium on the private equity and real estate investment trusts from beginning or expanding any further direct or indirect ownership, financial, or operational control of medical services right here in Minnesota. For 17 years, I have worked in a corporate for-profit health insurance company where I assist doctors and private equity companies with contracting, credentialing, ownership changes, billing issues, and more. I've seen firsthand that when private equity companies own all or part of a healthcare facility or practice, the quality of care goes down. The staff support and retention goes down. Billing issues mount and administrative costs go up. Fewer claim issues are addressed, and overbilling becomes something that they often try to see how long they can get away with it. Unless a patient knows how to navigate these complex billing procedures, their issues generally stay unresolved while the investors walk away with profits. It's one thing to increase the cost of care to deliver better services and influence better outcomes. It's another thing to do so with the sole goal of lining your pockets as an investor on the backs of Minnesotans seeking health care. The research is speaking to us loud and clear on this. Private equity and real estate investment trusts in health care are directly impacting the rising costs of care. Why is this? Because the bottom line for these companies is to simply make a profit, not to make people healthier. Healthy people produce less profits, and so there's a direct incentive for them to lower the quality of care and keep people sick longer, to keep staff underpaid and overworked, and to require performance measures that are near impossible to meet in settings where the appropriate care can make a huge difference in saving people's lives. Efficient health care and healthier patients are bad for business, and that should not be a reality that we idly accept. We should all be particularly alarmed about the declining care that we are seeing in nursing homes in particular, considering how much this body pays attention to the nursing home issues our state is facing. Research conducted by the Gerontological Society of America found that private equity ownership of nursing homes in Minnesota is directly correlated to worse care and outcomes, including higher administrative fees and lower occupancy rates. This study also found that workers were treated worse, benefits were less competitive and comprehensive, and rigorous financial audits were needed. Thankfully, we made some changes last year in this body that will improve some of this, but this bill is the next step to continue to ensure, at minimum, our eldest Minnesotans get the care they need at such a fragile stage of life. Our grandparents, our parents, our aunts and uncles, and our loved ones do not deserve worse care just so someone else can live the high life and get rich on their suffering. Members, I could go on and on about what I've seen in 17 years and the work I've done and the reasons about why this bill is important. But for the sake of time and because this is informational, I want to turn it over to my testifiers who can share some additional insights with you. Between now and when we come back to continue working on this bill and hopefully I pass it, I strongly invite everybody who has any questions, concerns, or interest in this area to reach out to me. There have been several letters submitted, and I'd ask that you keep your ears open when you're out in your communities talking to your neighbors, friends, and loved ones about how this could impact their lives as we continue to pursue this legislation. I invite you all to reach out with the recommendations, constructive feedback, and let me know how you think I can improve the bill that's before you today. I can't promise that today I will have all the answers to all of your questions, and so I want to premise that, but I can commit to you that I have an open mind and an open email and office to continue to intake your requests. I know you're committed to hearing about the issues that Minnesotans are facing with the rising cost of health care, and I appreciate your time. And that I'll turn it over to my testifier chair.
Thank you. And our first testifier is a familiar face, former Representative Hunter Cantrell. Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to express my deep appreciation for having this informational hearing. Members of the committee, my name is Hunter Cantrell. I'm a retired state representative and a current medical student at the University of Minnesota. I want to thank Representative Hansen for all her work and collaboration on this very important bill. I'm here today to testify in support because as a future physician, I believe that the cornerstone of healthcare should be that sacred bond between patient and clinician, working in allyship to help improve people's lives and keep them healthy. However, there is a growing threat to the sanctity of that trust. Private equity investment companies have functionally acquired large numbers of physician specialty practices and other healthcare services in our state. Real estate investment trusts, as Representative Hansen mentioned, own many facilities in which nonprofit healthcare services are housed. We in Minnesota believe that healthcare should be about doing what is best for patients, but medical services owned or operated by private equity companies often deviate significantly from the expectations we all share around high-quality, affordable healthcare. Private equity firms circumvent our corporate practice of medicine doctrine by forming managerial subsidiaries that then contract with medical practices to manage the, quote, non-clinical aspects of subspecialty practices, including workforce, HR, and finances. Except that we all know that those aspects are, in fact, inherently clinical aspects of practice. Mm-hmm. When private equity comes in, these firms often engage in a strategic dismantling of a medical service, including nursing homes and hospitals, in addition to physician practices and dental practices, mm-hmm. through the sale of physical assets, significant reductions in workforce to levels that data shows can be hazardous for patients, and burdening acquired facilities with debt that has on multiple occasions in different states required government bailouts. Or otherwise they face closure. This is not just a hypothetical threat. You will see in your letter packet a letter from Dr. Alec Ringeson, and he shared his deeply distressing experience with working for a specialty practice in Minnesota that was taken over by a private equity firm in the past few years. The simple fact is that these developments threaten healthcare affordability. Long-term access to care, especially in rural and underserved areas, and overall threaten the sustainability of our healthcare workforce. Through market monopolization as well, these firms are notorious for raising costs significantly for patients and engaging in anti-competitive practices. I support this bill because Minnesota healthcare must be first and foremost for the benefit of patients, and we as clinicians and future clinicians must be able to truly uphold our oath to do no harm by having the autonomy to focus always on the patient first. And with that, I thank you, Mr. Chair, and as well to Chair Liebling and Chair Cleavorn. Thank you all for your work and your time.
Thank you, Representative Cantrell. Next, we'll have Ben Baglio. Come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ben Baglio, and I'm proud to be testifying today on behalf of the Minnesota Nurses Association, whose 22,000 members represent 4 out of every 5 nurses that work actively at the bedside in Minnesota's hospitals. MNA is proud to support House File 4206, the bill to prohibit private equity firms from taking over hospitals, clinics, and other healthcare facilities, the ones that collectively make up our state healthcare delivery system. We support this effort because MNA believes that healthcare should be about patients, not profits, and that a ban on private equity owning healthcare facilities is maybe one of the most straightforward ways to prevent profiteers from taking advantage of patients in our healthcare system. As of 2019, private equity asset managers had record levels of available capital earmarked for healthcare investment, totaling almost $30 billion. This is despite the fact that private equity investment in healthcare companies carry substantial risk to patients and workers and even investors. The typical private equity investment playbook, pursuing outside returns over short time horizons while using high levels of debt, flies directly in the face of what patients need in their community healthcare providers. In states where private equity-owned healthcare is common, we see many trends: reduced staffing or filling beds without safe staffing levels, over-reliance on unlicensed staff to reduce labor costs, a failure to provide adequate training to care staff, pressure on providers to provide unnecessary and potentially costly services, and a violation of regulations required for participants in Medicare and Medicaid, such as anti-kickback provisions, as evidenced by numerous examples of litigation. I know this bill is informational today, and we hope that this committee and other legislators will move forward to address this issue in the future. And please know that M&A and our nurses will be there to support the work of keeping private equity firms out of our healthcare system. Thank you, Representative Hansen, for leading the way here, and thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Gene Foreman. Come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Gene Foreman, and I am a retired nurse. I retired in 2021 from a local metro hospital after more than 20 years working primarily in ICU and most recently in perianesthesia, which is surgical prep and recovery. Along with nursing, I was a union steward at the hospital I worked at. During that time, I represented nurses along with union staff as a transition was occurring within the anesthesia department at the hospital. The new management of the anesthesiologists and CRNAs was insisting on logistical changes that didn't seem to benefit patients or other staff. They wanted a remote procedure locations in the building to consolidate to the main OR area to maximize and concentrate anesthesia staff to one area to provide service. That meant relocating staff, equipment, as well as redirecting patients to our main OR area. This resulted in layoffs and early retirement for some nurses, loss of scheduling preferences, necessity to retrain to different types of surgeries, and then also resuming on-call schedules. The main OR waiting rooms now had to accommodate more patients and visitors, and maybe a bit more chaos. Surgery areas, including prep and recovery, now had to handle more patients with procedures not normally cared for, also that the anesthesia group could be efficient. Patients in some of these remote areas of the hospital knew their staff, that they felt comfortable in a large hospital setting by receiving very personalized care without explaining at each visit what they were needing during their procedures. While there isn't a cell on a spreadsheet to enter patient comfort, quality of care, or clinical expertise, these are very important components of providing quality health care. The adage that a nurse is a nurse is a nurse never was and still isn't true, and private equity has no place in healthcare. And I hope you'll support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Dr. Najaha Moose. Come forward, state your record name for the record, proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Dr. Najaha Moose. I'm a senior resident physician at the University of Minnesota's Department of Family Medicine and Community Health. I'm here in support of House Floor 4206. I am co-chief resident at Woodwinds Hospital as well as seeing patients at Bethesda Clinic. In our clinic, we serve a largely refugee population with many socioeconomic barriers to health. Many of our patients rely on primary care for mental health and substance use treatment. They depend on the continuity of care provided by our clinic, which is deeply rooted in our community. However, the acquisition of primary care clinics by private equity, including real estate investment trusts, threatened to disrupt this continuity of care. physicians find themselves grappling with the conflict between their ethical duty to prioritize patient care and the pressure from shareholders to prioritize profitability. Just this week, the New York Times published an article detailing how large insurers are working with a little-known data company to boost their profits, often at the expense of patients and doctors. The Times interviewed more than 100 patients, doctors, billing specialists, and reviewed more than 50,000 records and concluded that the smaller the payout to doctors, the bigger the profits for the insurer and private equity firm. And patients are on the hook for unpaid bills for out-of-network substance use and mental health treatment. This trend not only prioritizes profit over patient care, but also perpetuates inequities in health outcomes and exacerbates the healthcare crisis we are facing post-pandemic. It is our moral imperative to advocate for policies that prioritize patient well-being over profit margins, to ensure that every Minnesotan, regardless of background or circumstance, receives the care they deserve. In conclusion, let us stand united in our commitment to health equity, in our dedication to serving the underserved, and in our resolve to ensure that Minnesota remains a beacon of inclusivity and compassion for all. Thank you.
Thank you. Our last testifier is Justin Stofren. Come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony. Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson and committee members. My name is Justin Stofren. I'm the Anti-Monopoly Director at the Minnesota Farmers Union, which is a grassroots organization representing family farmers, ranchers, and rural communities across Minnesota. I appreciate the opportunity to testify on the important issue of private equity investment in healthcare and thank Representative Hansen for her leadership on this issue and this legislation. Our members voted at our most recent annual convention to make the issues of monopoly power as well as healthcare affordability and access key priorities for the year. And addressing private equity roll-ups in healthcare and across the economy is key to addressing those challenges. Minnesota's healthcare system is rapidly consolidating to the detriment of patients, communities, and healthcare workers, and private equity is one of the forces driving that. As Representative Hansen mentioned, there's a recent study of Minnesota nursing homes that she detailed and the outcomes there. In addition, the Twin Cities and St. Cloud metro areas have one private equity company that now owns more than 30% of the physician market for certain specialties, and that trend's only growing. The strategy of private equity is to consolidate. PE firms are rolling up companies and industries as diverse as HVAC installers, lumber yards, fast food franchises, housing, and even minor league baseball teams, where one company owns a fourth of them. But few of those industries are as essential and important as healthcare. House File 4206 would take a key step towards addressing the harmful consolidation in our healthcare system and build off the important work done last session by Representative Bierman to address the consolidation in hospitals. I thank you for the opportunity to testify and for having this hearing, and to Representative Hansen again for her leadership. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll now move to member discussion on the bill. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hansen. My question is, you know, I mean, we've seen massive closures, particularly of nursing, not just nursing homes, but nursing home beds, which has been the equivalent of scores of additional nursing homes closing. And we have seen some of these facilities purchased by these companies. Mm-hmm. My question to you is, what is our solution if there are no other potential buyers and these folks are willing to take these facilities over? What's our solution if right now these are the only buyers? Where do we go?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative New Brindley. That's a very fair question, because I think that's the position a lot of folks are in, is that if this is where the money is, then what do we do as a result of that? I think that that's why I brought this bill forward, is because I think it's due time that we start collaborating and putting our heads together and figuring out what kind of guardrails do we think should be around sales like this. Presently, there are few to none. I think that my proposal in my bill is an all-out moratorium. Is that necessarily the best option immediately? I'm not sure. That's why this is informational. But I think to your point that there has to be guardrails around what they're allowed to manage, what those profit margins look like, how they're allowed to drive up the costs of care. For example, in the nursing home piece, there was a study that was done by the National Bureau of Economic Research, found that 20,000 people in nursing homes died when they didn't need to. And so if that's, you know, our family members, people we love, I think those statistics that we're seeing, the people who are buying them are not taking care of the people who are there, and therefore the necessity of this bill kind of presents itself, if you will. So I think there's having guardrails around that would be important, but I would definitely love to talk with you offline. I know you've done a ton of work around this and would be really curious to hear what you have to say.
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Equity firms are certainly increasing their concentration and control, and certainly one of the forces driving healthcare. Thank you for bringing the bill forward. You have a great grasp of this issue and how big of a problem it is. There have been thousands and thousands of purchases of equity, of healthcare across the country. You just have to pick up the paper daily and you'll see it. I saw one that last Friday that talked about when equity obtains these facilities, within a year or two, costs to patients are 50% higher. Yeah. And Dr. Mousset highlighted another article I saw today from, I think that was the multi-plan issue in New York Times. So, I mean, you have to have your eyes wide shut to not see this as an issue. Mm-hmm. This is affecting all of our constituents. And this is something that we as legislators, we need to address. So thank you for bringing the bill forward. I signed on to the bill. I look forward to working with you on this as it moves forward and improving it and addressing this critical issue. Thank you.
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Hansen, for this conversation. I think it's an important one. And it's certainly understandable, I think, especially given the coverage a lot of times of certain, I think, private equity firms that do have a strategy that involves, you know, buying and maybe even stripping the value of assets in sort of a short-term perspective. I think that it gets tough when we legislate in this area because that's painting with a little bit too broad of a brush when we're talking about private equity. There are private equity firms, and they don't tend to get newspaper coverage, that buy, you know, businesses for the long term and operate them for the long term. And I think that challenge, you know, in trying to draw that distinction is illustrated by the way that this bill tries to define private equity firms or private equity company. It says a publicly traded or non-publicly traded entity that collects capital investments from individuals or entities. I think that covers every for-profit company. Any company in which somebody has an equity investment, I think that would even cover, for example, a purely provider-owned clinic, which is maybe not the A-plus gold standard. Maybe some people would disagree with that, but that's pretty close to the gold standard in terms of, you know, doctors owning their own clinics, for example. So I think I appreciate the acknowledgement that this needs a lot of work. Let me just make a couple of comments, big picture comments as you're going forward. I think actually investment is good, mm-hmm. and we should want investment, including sometimes equity investment in healthcare. And in particular, I think there are three situations in which equity, even private equity investment in healthcare could be good. One is, you know, when you're talking about investment in growth or the efficiency or technology, sometimes the providers, you know, who want to have a good clinic that runs well can bring in outside capital, and that can be good in terms of providing a better experience for their customer or their patients. The second would be, you know, the kind of distressed healthcare entities that Representative Brindley is talking about. Mm-hmm. If a healthcare entity is in distress and the choice is between closure and investment, we should be trying to think about having the full option of investments open to them to deal with that distress. And the third one is when we're talking about succession planning. So to think about that provider, let's say we do, you know, change the definition so that a provider-owned entity, something where all the owners are partners, are doctors, mm-hmm. And they're dealing with the succession planning situation where someone has worked for 40 years and built value in their business, Are we harming the value of the work that they have put into building that business by cutting off certain buyers from paying for them? So we do have to be really, really careful about, is there a way to deal with, you know, vulture funds, if that's the right way to think about some certain private, and I think that's a fair way to actually describe some private equity business models.
Yeah.
You know, how do we distinguish between vulture funds on the one hand, or, you know, antitrust concerns? I appreciate that point. Obviously, we do have antitrust laws that deal with that, and maybe, you know, Representative Bierman has ideas about how to beef those up. I might not agree with all of those, but that's, you know, that's part of the conversation. Versus, you know, a private equity fund that maybe their business model is to buy a business and hold it for 50 years, maybe even a minority interest in the business, and to increase the, you know, efficiency and the way that business operates. So there's a lot there that, you know, those are just kind of big picture comments as we go forward. Thanks.
Representative Cleburne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I want to thank Representative Hansen and former Representative Cantrell for bringing this bill forward. You know, I think equity companies are things that we love and we hate, right? When they're in our 401ks and they're doing well, we love them. And when they're in our healthcare system and we're following the dollars and we're paying more, we hate them, right? So it's a mixed bag of goods. I think one of the conversations we had today about owner-operated equity, that's one situation, right? When it's privately held and it's privately operated, individual doctor, one doctor, their private patient clinic, okay? But when we start getting into large entities that are accepting many, 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 many of our state dollars, asking for state bonding, asking for state, then I think we need to take a closer look and see, you know, really who's paying for this entity and who's reaping the benefit from the entity. When we're talking about the growth, the technology, and even the succession planning that we heard about earlier today, we again have to think about how is this impacting the state budget? Mm-hmm. Are we getting the bang for the buck that we want, right? Are the Minnesotans who are paying those taxes actually receiving the benefits for those taxes that they need to receive? But I do think we walk into a very sticky wicket when we start looking at how hard it is to track the money, mm-hmm. right? We don't have access to the financial records that we need to have access to see who's a good operator and who's a poor operator. Those numbers are held pretty tightly, and I think we need to start thinking about how we expose, you know, really who the good people are and who the bad people are in this entity. And I'm very concerned about the triple N leases that are being signed and, you know, who's paying. It appears to me that we are in the public side paying the expenses of liability, maintenance, and taxes, mm-hmm. and all of the profit is going to the private side. So, and again, I'm talking about the use of state dollars. And we're going to hear later, you know, private equity comes and asks us for money in a whole host of ways, mm-hmm. right? And in looking at the private equity shareholder project report that came out in 2001, one of the things that it said is after private equity buyout, management fees increased by 7.7%, lease payments increased by 75%, and interest payments increased by 325%. But the cash on hand decreases by 38%. So we're hearing there's no money, state bail us out, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And I just keep thinking, we're paying a ton of money. Where's it going? Because the employees aren't getting the payments, mm-hmm. the patient isn't getting the service, and somebody's walking away with a lot of cash. Mm-hmm. So I just want to make sure that as we look at this, we are also demanding full disclosure of, if you're saying you're poor and you're asking for state money, open your books. We want to see your books, and we want to know who's reaping that profit. Thank you.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hansen, just want to seek some clarification, and it's kind of building on what Representative Claiborne was talking about. The title of this Section 1, Private Equity Companies and Real Estate Investment Trusts. My question is, do you see these as one entity or two entities?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. I think as the conversations begin, we find that the
The problems that each create are similar, but as I continue to work on this, I am beginning to feel that there will be maybe a Section 1 private equity companies and Section 2 real estate investment trusts. I do think that we have different parameters and different guardrails that will eventually end up around each of these, because I think that there's two different, to represent Cleavorn's point, two different ways that this is being weaponized against Minnesotans and their overall access to quality, affordable health care. I can say my experience for 17 years working predominantly with these private equity companies on the insurance side of things, I see some of the decisions they make. For example, you know, they may have, let's say the previous owner was with an insurance company as an in-network provider for 30 plus years. Their, you know, patients' entire families have been going to this doctor using their family's union insurance, whatever it might be. But then once the private equity company purchases it, that company can then decide to terminate that contract and thus make the doctor now out of network for this family or the entire provider system, all under the name of making a profit. That's not necessarily a decision that a real estate company would make. And so I think for that reason, among many others, that's one example of why I think we will probably end up splitting these up and having two different pieces there.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hansen, I'm pleased to hear you say that, because I don't know that the physical campus provider is the same as who occupies that physical property on the campus. Sure. And it could be that the private equity company also owns the real estate, but in this day and age, you see a lot of separation on this. Mm-hmm. And to Representative Claiborne's point, net leases and revenue sharing leases are very popular right now. And the Mall of America exists because of revenue sharing leases. Let's make no mistake at all about that, right? You pay a base rent, and I always tell people when I teach them in real estate, the one who pays the most expensive rent is the one who's in there in the holiday season per square foot. They don't make a nickel really on what's going on. But your Macy's, your others that are larger because you got more cash registers, that's where the owner recovers and to participate and share in the costs and expenses on this. My experience in private real estate investment is it can buy property in desirable areas. It can, on its own dime, construct the campus, the bricks and mortar, and then it can, in turn, lease to whether it's a private doctor, dentist, or what have you, and create a venue for smaller operators to exist where they don't have the capital to be able to do that on their own. And so I would strongly encourage you to look at separating these two, because mm-hmm. the Real Estate Investment Trust provides mm-hmm. a landing spot for these businesses. Again, if they're uncoupled from the private equity part of the equation, yeah, some may own both, but they may be independent. And it's a dynamic world out there and ever changing. And so the real estate industry is a complex industry as well. And to Representative Claiborne's point, you and I can purchase in our 401ks mm-hmm. interests in REITs, as they're called in the industry, real estate mm-hmm. investment trusts, if we want to diversify our portfolio from just stocks and bonds to hard assets that are retained by this, which many financial planners would tell you a solidly diversified portfolio is a portfolio that stands a good chance of being able to meet the needs that you have set up that portfolio for. So, sure. Mr. Chair, I'm pleased to hear that, and it looked like maybe Representative Hansen wanted to respond to my inquiry on that as well.
I'll give her a chance to give closing comments. Did you have anything else you wanted to say, Representative Driscoll?
Not unless she had something that she was going to respond to that she wanted me to respond back to, or I was looking to respond back to. But
Representative Hansen, you can go into your closing comments if you want, or if you wanted to say something to Representative Driscoll, you're welcome to do that.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair. I'll wrap up. Just, I want to respect your time. I know you have more bills on the agenda today. And I appreciate this conversation, because I, too, have learned the differences of how private equity versus real estate kind of does some of these things. I will say that when real estate decides that all maintenance, deferment, lawn work, repairs, all of that also goes with it, I have an issue with it, because if you're owning the real estate, you're profiting from the real estate, you should maintain some of that real estate back, to represent Cleavorn's point as well, that there should be some there in this arena. Now, I have very close ties to real estate investment, so I also understand that it's very complicated, so I will probably go home and hear about this, but I think in the realm of when we're providing a necessity like healthcare, that it deserves stronger guardrails than what we have maybe in some of the other parts of real estate. I think you'll probably catch my drift here on this, but Chair and members, I really appreciate your time. I do want to recognize Representative Bierman for all the work you've done in this arena to really set the national stage for how we can begin to have these conversations and really try to talk about this in a different way. And I couldn't do this without your mentorship. So thank you very much for your help on that too. And thank you, Chair, for your time today.
Thank you, Representative Hanson and former Representative Cantrell. I appreciate it. Good to see you again. And thanks for for a really good discussion on that bill. The next item on our agenda is House File 4151. As Representative Cha comes forward, I will move that House File 4151 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Representative Cha, to your bill.
Thank you, Chair. As of some time, I will condense this. In 1996, the Minnesota Legislature created the Auto Theft Prevention Grant Program. This program is funded through the 50-cent surcharge on insurance premiums collected every 6 months. The program uses a competitive grant process to make the money available to local governments to address auto theft. This currently includes 25 law enforcement agencies, 4 prosecutor offices, and 3 nonprofits, and it continues to grow. Programs such as the Ramsey County Youth Auto Theft Prevention Program, the Star Chase Auto License Plate Readers. This bill proposes to increase the 50-cent surcharge to $1. This would increase the fund from $4.5 million to $9 million annually. There has not been a fee increase since the inception of this program, which was established in 1996. In 2023, as auto thefts continue to rise across the state, Ramsey County saw a 36% decrease in auto theft. And with that, I'd like to yield to the testifier. Thank you.
All right. And I see we had hoped that the county attorney would be here, but I'm assuming that Mr. Hazzi sitting there means that he's not. And so, Mr. Hazzi, if you want to state your name for the record, proceed your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Mark Hazzi. I'm an assistant Ramsey County attorney. And yes, Mr. Chair, County Attorney Choi had hoped to be here himself, but he had a conflicting speaking engagement, so he couldn't make it in time. I'll be brief. In 2020 to 2021, when in Ramsey County and across the state and across the country, we saw a drastic increase in violent crime and also auto theft and the violent act of carjacking. County Attorney Choi brought together an informal group of stakeholders, leaders in Ramsey County called the Violence Reduction Leadership Group, and to start looking at, come together and collaborate on ways to address the new and increased crimes in the county. And one initiative that came out of that was this Youth Auto Theft Intervention Program. It's a focused deterrence program, meaning that the idea is that community, law enforcement, prosecutors work together. They identify the people that are committing the vast majority of the crimes, which is typically a smaller number. And then they work to move them out of that behavior, as well as having traditional law enforcement and prosecution approaches. We learned and know that in Ramsey County, as in other places, a large number, a majority of the people committing these crimes are youth. It can be hard to prosecute a young person who's just found in a car that's been stolen because there's not enough evidence to tie them to the actual theft. Also with youth, the alternatives for punishment are limited. Sometimes they'll go to a residential facility, but they'll come back into the community. We also know that many of these youth are committing many of these offenses each. So if you can get a small number, you can really have an outsized impact on the crime. As I said, this is a collaborative program with the county attorney's office, the sheriff's office, and community. In your packet, you should have a letter of support from Ramsey County Sheriff Bob Fletcher. And as Representative Cha said, we were able to do this because of funding through the Department of Commerce Auto Theft Prevention Fund. So additional funding could not only help us to expand this along with traditional law enforcement responses. We have a dedicated investigator, a dedicated prosecutor for auto theft. Other jurisdictions do as well. But also, as Representative Cha said, as auto theft is at a historic high, and it's remaining as high or in some cases going up around the state. In Ramsey County, we've seen a 36% reduction in auto theft, and we think it's attributable to this program. So with that, our other testifier will talk a little bit more about the details of the program. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And while the other testifier is coming up, I'm going to give just pause for a second to give a roadmap for the rest of the hearing and the rest of the day. Since we are approaching 2:30, which is our normal adjourning time, we will go over time today. We will have to recess for a floor session in order to make sure that members have time to get over to the caucuses. We'll recess at 10 to 3. Then we will return when the floor session is over, about 15 minutes after the floor session is over. Members should watch for an email from Mr. Brown, the committee administrator. One last note for members, the room will be secured while we are gone. If you want to leave your committee materials here, you are welcome to do so. The room will be secured. For members of the public, that means that you need to will need to leave the room, and you should not leave behind anything that you will want to have access to while we are away. With that, we'll move back to testimony on this. Tyrone Terrill, you state your name for the record. Proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tyrone Terrill. I am the Ramsey County Auto Theft Program manager for the program. It's my third year with the program. And as Mark said, we've seen a significant decrease in auto theft, carjackings, because I believe we have a great partnership between his office, Ramsey County Attorney's Office, Sheriff Fletcher's office, and the community. So it can't be one without the other. And because of that partnership, we've been able to have a significant reduction. And part of that is what we call our intervention and prevention. Most of the young people that we work with are between the ages of 10 and 17. So these are young people, extremely young people, that are stealing cars, carjacking, doing the robberies. And part of what we were able to do was bring on a psychologist who helped the families understand what triggered this individual, particularly at 10, 11, 12 years old, to get involved in this illegal activity. And because of the early intervention, we believe it's been one of the major reasons we've had significant reduction in these crimes. And that we believe this additional funding will allow us to not only reduce it, but I believe eliminate a great deal of it. Because many of these families, we've learned, have significant problems beyond just the theft. Of the 100 people we worked with in the past year, only two dads have shown up. The rest of it has been mothers. So we've seen only two fathers out of over 100 young men and women. And so we're trying to engage, particularly our dads. A friend of mine, Spike Moss, has a saying that if men stand up, little boys will sit down, little girls will sit down. And so we need our men to take their rightful place. But until then, the intervention and prevention component is extremely important. So thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Aaron Cocking. Mr. Cocking.
Chair Stevenson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Aaron Cocking, President and CEO of the Insurance Federation of Minnesota. The Insurance Federation of Minnesota represents insurers doing business in Minnesota, including the auto insurers who collect and remit this surcharge. I want to make it clear that the Insurance Federation has been supportive of the purpose of this surcharge since we helped to create and establish it in 1996. Our industry welcomes and supports grants to help reduce and deter auto theft. We've seen the success of what this money can be used for. The point I want to raise today, Chair Stevenson, is we need to make sure that that money goes to the purpose for what is intended. Those of you who have been around for a while might remember that up until just a few years ago, the legislature had written into statute that the first $1.3 million collected for this purpose was automatically transferred to the general fund to help balance the state budget. In fact, in 2010, the legislature was so desperate that they took another $1 million from this account, leaving only $200,000 to go towards auto theft prevention grants. Our concern with raising this fee has nothing to do with the value of what these grants can accomplish. Doubling the amount collected offers an even easier target for the legislature to poach the next time there's a budget deficit. Getting that money back took over a decade, even in years when the state had a surplus. We don't want to go through that again. Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the chance to testify. I thought it was important to get those points on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Cocking. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify as to this bill? Seeing none, we'll move on to member discussion and questions. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize, this amount was said, but I'm wondering if you can just tell us again what the total amount was that was paid out in last year.
Representative Todd, if you know it, otherwise we can.
I don't know that.
I don't know if Mr. Hazy or if the department's here as well. But Mr. Hazy, if you have that figure.
Mr. Chair, the department can give a more accurate answer if there's somebody here. I think it's around $4 million a year that's brought in.
It's 4 million. That it should be about 4 million raised. I don't know how much went out.
Right.
Assistant Commissioner, do you have that? You can. If you don't have it, you can just shake your head from where you are. I can see your face. But if you do, you're welcome to come down.
Mr. Chair, maybe she has an answer to my question earlier today, too. Who knows?
Welcome back, Assistant Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, representatives, members. Again, Jacqueline Olson, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Commerce. Can you repeat the question?
Representative Brindley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I'm just wondering, it sounds like $4.5 million came in, or approximately, and I'm wondering how much went out in those grants.
Assistant Commissioner.
So $4.5 million was awarded as far as what went out, if that's what you're asking.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that's the number that was awarded. Okay. So my question is, and I'm wondering, Mr. Haase? I apologize if I say that incorrectly. My question is, I'm wondering if, you know, I'm looking at some of the grantees, and I'm wondering the youth auto theft program that you talked about, is that the Ramsey Youth Project?
Mr. Haase.
Mr. Chair and Representative Greeling, this is not a separate nonprofit organization. This is a collaborative program, and so the funding actually goes to an entity called Haley Q. Brown. And they administer it. And then Mr. Terrell is with the African American Leadership Council, and in that capacity he acts as the manager, and they hire a couple of navigators that work with the youth and families.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then another almost $334 million went directly to the Ramsey County Attorney's Office?
Thousand.
Sorry, what did I say?
Million.
Yes, thousand. You're correct. Thank you.
Mr. Haase.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Brindley, I don't have the exact breakdown here, but additional funding in Ramsey County went to a dedicated prosecutor in our office who focuses on auto theft and works with this program, a dedicated investigator with the Ramsey County Sheriff's Office. I believe the sheriff gets some funding for other deterrence efforts. And then there may be numbers here that are including some money that St. Paul gets, but, you know, all the jurisdictions in Ramsey County have received a large proportion of the overall funds.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, it looks like St. Paul got over $400,000. So there is a lot of money moving around in this, especially, I mean, if we can pay for a dedicated investigator, prosecutor, plus there's money in the city of St. Paul, plus there's money to this youth prevention program. No one here will be surprised that while it seems that the program is a good program, no one will be surprised that I am concerned about directly raising costs for Minnesotans. And this is anyone who owns a vehicle. And with how much pain we've already inflicted on Minnesota families, this is just yet another tax on Minnesota families. And this one, it may feel small, but every individual tax feels small. But you know what? We raise taxes, and by we, of course, I mean all of you, raise taxes on Minnesota families by $10 million less.
Billion.
$10 billion! I keep getting my millions and billions and thousands. $10 billion last year. And now we're trying to do it again. It's not okay. We got to stop somewhere. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, sorry.
Mr. Haase?
I don't want to comment on the policy parts of that, but I just wanted to make a point of clarification as this bill gets discussed more. Representative Grayling, you said that it applies to all auto owners. It only applies to people who have a comprehensive and collision insurance. So if you're somebody that's not paying, you know, for whatever reason doesn't want to pay or can't pay for all of that, just liability, it doesn't apply there. I just wanted to make that clarification. Thank you.
Representative O'Driscoll.
I might want to move over one seat for bottom to suggest, because I'm in swinging distance of Representative New Brindley. And that is, why don't we make this like $5 and just get rid of, you know, crime altogether and lower everybody's premiums so people can have a savings. I don't know that anybody can tell me what's going to happen if we go from 50 cents to a dollar. Is there a matrix that we can look at that's going to reduce this? Or is it, well, we won't know until we raise the fee as to whether or not we're going to do this. And a dollar and a half or $2, and do I hear three? insurance premiums are awfully expensive right now, and Mr. Cocking is 100% right. When this state looks is short of money, it goes to lots of creative places to get this money, because I've been hearing good times and in bad and in sickness and in health. But I don't know that I necessarily have a question. I just wanted to get that on the record, that it's important for us to make sure that we understand that all of our ills and problems aren't going to be fixed by going from 50 cents to a dollar. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You represent Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, I don't want to prolong the agony here, but, you know, keep Mr. Cocking's point, which we were all kind of smiling about, that was under Governor Pawlenty. You know, if you want to pretend that you don't have to, that you have enough revenue coming in to meet the needs of the state, then you go and, you know, rob all these little funds. That was what Governor Pawlenty and Republicans did in those years. I mean, I just thought, since I was here then, I should speak up about that. I don't recall DFLers ever resorting to that, because you may not like us sometimes asking people to pay more, but at least it's honest.
Representative Shaw, closing comments.
Thank you so much for the discussion, and please keep our communities safe, and thank you.
All right, and with that, the bill is laid over. And I'll turn it over to Vice Chair Cattizzi.
And to whom it may concern, the bill author, Chair, or Chair Cattizzi Watum, do we have any kind of an idea that we think we might be back this evening for from session to pick up the matter that we're about to have before us? There have been a lot of folks who have been here and very professional and patient, and I want to give them some kind of an idea so they can plan their day accordingly.
Certainly. Representative Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, our intention is to resume 15 minutes after adjournment of the floor session. As you are aware, Representative O'Driscoll, that is pretty hard to predict exactly when that will occur. I think we have four bills on the calendar for the day today, one of which has multiple amendments, so I would expect it will be a few hours, but I don't want to be any more predictive than that, because I feel like I would risk misleading people.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you. Just again, a follow-up parliamentary question. Out of respect for the season that it is for some of the members of our legislature, we do take a dinner break. I'm assuming that we will not be meeting during the dinner break if and when that comes today. Is that correct?
Chair Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, thank you very much. That is correct. During is the month of Ramadan, so depending on when floor session concludes, we will make sure to allow time for the observance of the end of Ramadan.
Representative O'Driscoll.
And just for clarity, we'll be going into session at 3:30, probably recessing to take care of caucus business, getting on the floor on these. Last week, that break was about 7:30 to 8:30, although we can't continue to know for sure. But that does provide people some pinging points to figure out what the rest of their evening might look like on this. And again, I thank people for their interest in this bill and hope that they can come back later this evening.
Representative O'Driscoll and Chair Stevenson, just for reference, sunset tonight is at 7:59 p.m. So the break is typically around that when folks can break their fast. So if we're ready to move into the bill, I do want to address everybody in the audience and thank you all for being here with us today. But I hope everyone can listen carefully. There are so many folks who wish to speak and who feel very strongly about this bill, and we're really happy that you're here to share your thoughts. However, to keep this moving, and when we return later on tonight, if we could just adhere to a couple guidelines. First, as everyone was told when signing up to testify, please do keep your comments limited to 2 minutes. We will be keeping time and we'll give you notice when your time has expired. I will call two people down at one time, so there's two chairs up here. So please, when your name is called, come down to sit so that you're ready to speak promptly when it's your turn. And then next, when testifying, please do keep your comments limited to the content of the bill and the amendment, and refrain from speaking to personalities and motivations. Please be respectful to members of our staff on the committee and other testifiers and members in the audience. We again appreciate you joining us here to share your thoughts. And with that out of the way, Chair Stevenson will move that House File 5274 be re-referred to the State and Local Government and Finance Committee. Chair Stevenson, Would you like to move the and describe the A4 amendment?
Madam Chair, I move the A4 amendment, which puts the bill in the shape I'd like the committee to consider it. It clarifies a number of pieces of language, and I'll speak to that more when I introduce the bill, but it's a clarification amendment.
All right. All in favor of the author's A4 amendment to get the bill in the shape he would like, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The motion prevails, and the A4 amendment is adopted. Chair Stevenson, to your bill as amended.
Madam Chair, members, there have been many misunderstandings about what this bill does or what it is attempting to do, so let me start out by clearly stating what we are trying to achieve with this bill. First, we want to reverse the Racing Commission's decision last week and make clear that historic horse racing slot machines are not permitted at our state's tracks. Second, we want to close a loophole in state law that allows for stadium-style card games. And third, we want to clarify the jurisdiction of the Racing Commission to ensure that we don't end up right here again in the future. Now let me be clear about what this bill is not intended to do. It is not intended to change anything about actual horse racing in Minnesota. It is not intended to restrict the type of bets people can place on horse racing. It is not intended to stop or alter any kind of horse racing that is currently legal in Minnesota. In fact, this bill isn't intended to do anything at all to real live horse racing. It is also not intended to prohibit any type of card game that is currently being played at the card clubs at the tracks, aside from the stadium style card games. I've heard from many folks that the bill language as introduced would have a broader impact on the operation of the tracks than the intention I just described. The author's amendment, which was just adopted, was designed to address those concerns. But if folks think the amended language is still broader than the goals that I articulated, if folks think it prohibits things aside from historic horse racing slot machines or stadium-style card games, then I encourage you to come and talk to me about it. I'm open to further discussions and clarifications. We only want to address historic horse racing slot machines, stadium card games, and the jurisdiction of the Racing Commission and nothing else. Some folks have accused me of having it out for the tracks. That's not true. I've got no problem with the tracks. I do have a problem with the Racing Commission going beyond its statutory authority, but I've got no problem with the tracks. I've been to the tracks many times. They're a good asset to our community, and I hope they continue to be a good asset to our community for a long time. We've had a good discussion about historic horse racing slot machines in this committee last week, so I won't repeat myself too much on that. I think these slot machines are not lawful at the tracks. I think the Racing Commission took an unlawful action last week when they approved them, and this bill corrects it. We discussed the Alcohol Gambling Enforcement Division letter last week, but to remind members, the staff review, and these are civil servants, not political employees, appointees, concluded that historic horse racing slot machines are slot machines, that they are not parimutuel, and that they are unlawful gambling devices under Minnesota law. Accordingly, they should not be at the tracks. The other subject this bill addresses is stadium-style card games. What's that? By way of background, the tracks are allowed to have a card club under Minnesota Statute 240.30. Subdivision 8 of that statute is titled Limitations, and it says that a card club can only have a maximum of 80 tables. That limit has been placed since 2012, before which it was 50 tables. The problem is there's no definition of a table in state law. If you've ever been to a casino or a card club, you might think table is a self-explanatory term. I think we can probably all picture a blackjack table with a dealer, up to seven participants around. But technology has changed the game. Interblock technology allows one table with one human dealer to serve many, many additional players. Instead of players sitting at the traditional table with real cards being dealt to them, players sit at a video terminal with digital images of the cards dealt by the dealer, where video images of the cards dealt by the dealer are displayed. Here's how one Minnesota track describes it. Play community card blackjack where dealers deal their cards while players place their bets from their very own PlayStation. This innovative gaming platform is comprised of high-definition LCD display at individual PlayStations and a dealer-assist blackjack table. This form of blackjack gives players more hands per hour and lower buy-ins. Where a traditional table is limited by the space available for players to play, stadium-style card games have no such limitation. Not only that, but players can play multiple hands at once. So this technology renders the table limitation in Minnesota statute meaningless. The legislature wouldn't have put a table limitation if it didn't intend for it to mean something, and the Racing Commission shouldn't render a statute passed by the legislature meaningless. if we want to raise the number of tables at a card club, as we did in 2012, we should do it by statute, not by an unelected commission. The Racing Commission has proved stadium card game tables with 11 player terminals, each of which can have three hands of cards being played at a time. So that's a total of 33 hands being played off of one dealer. That's more than four times the capacity of a traditional table, which only allows seven hands at a time. So this bill corrects two overreaches by the Racing Commission and attempts to clarify their jurisdiction so we don't end up in this mess again. I will add that I think it's probably time for us to examine how gambling is regulated in Minnesota, because what we're doing right now isn't working. We have four gambling regulators in Minnesota: the Racing Commission, the Gambling Control Board, the Lottery, the Alcohol and Gambling Division of the Department of Public Safety. That's a fragmented regulatory structure, which is leading to contradiction and controversy. That, Madam Chair, I know there are a number of testifiers, and I think maybe we can fit in one or two.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're actually at 250 right now, so instead of letting one person try to get their 2 minutes in before we have to leave for our caucuses on the floor session, I think we should just recess now. So everyone in the audience can look. If you've signed up to testify, you will get an email about when we will return after the floor session today. And then if you don't currently get those emails and you're not signed up to testify, there is a subscribe button on the committee website where you can ensure that you will receive Mr. Brown's email later on this evening. So thank you so much for your time, and we look forward to seeing you later. We are in recess.